I'm going to call the order of this meeting of the House Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Before we get to our first item of business, I want to welcome the 9th and 10th grade students from Spring Grove Public Schools, who I think are in the back. Thanks for being with us today.
And New Brindley.
Oh, wait. yeah, that was all right. Yeah. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 18th, 2024. Representative Freiberg, do you have a motion?
I will move approval of the minutes of March 18th.
Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes from March 18th, 2024. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 3566 from Representative Hollins. I will move House File 3566 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I will also move the A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment, I presume gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
That's correct, Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Representative Hollins, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Very excited to be here. I'm going to try to talk really fast because I will say a lot if I don't. So we've been working on this bill for over 2 years. It is an electronics waste collection bill. Currently, Minnesota is only collecting about 20% of our electronic waste. Everything else is either incinerated, landfilled, or sits in our closets and our basements. And I don't know about you, but I've got a whole basement full of old laptop computers that I'm not sure what to do with. We believe that there are several reasons for this dismal collection numbers. First of all, the current e-waste bill is from 2007, which is outdated and doesn't encompass the entire e-waste stream as it currently exists. Just for reference, smartphones were not something that were around in 2007. They came onto the first iPhone came onto the market in 2007, and it was introduced actually after this bill passed in 2007. Also, the current program relies on charging residents to recycle and relies heavily on tax dollars. So we know by studies that have been done that when individuals show up to bring their recycling material to a facility and they're told that they are going to be charged a certain amount of money, they will take their products and they will leave and go dump them into the regular waste stream. And then finally, there's just not enough collection sites across the entire state of Minnesota. We know that there are several counties that provide collection days. We know that there are, you know, Best Buys and Apple stores which do provide e-waste collection. But Minnesota is a really big state, and there are a ton of people who don't live within easy reach of a Best Buy or an Apple store. The good news is that if we get to 100% collection of our e-waste, the collection and processing of that waste could generate 1,700 good jobs. We can recover precious metals that would provide almost 40% of the metals we need for the energy transition. And we can save our state money by extending the life of our landfills, preventing structure fires created by lithium-ion batteries in our waste stream, and preventing lead and heavy metal pollution from that dumped electronic waste. I do want to bring to your attention there was one of our testifiers who wasn't able to be here from the National Waste and Recycling Association said that based on a survey of materials and recovery facility operators, each has more than 18 fires per year, which has led to skyrocketing insurance rates, which have increased 10 to 50 times due to these fires. And these are fires from lithium ion batteries that are contained in, you know, everything from your phone to your AirPods to almost anything that we use, our disposable vapes, et cetera. So that is one of the many reasons why we are working on this bill and why we believe it's important to get our electronics out of the regular waste stream and, in fact, create its own stream. I have several testifiers here, and I will turn it over to them.
Great. Yeah, we will move through testimony at this point. Just for everyone who is testifying on this bill today, we need everyone to limit their testimony to 2 minutes apiece. We'll be keeping time, and if you go over, I'll have to ask you to wrap up your remarks. So our first testifier today is Maria Jensen, will be followed by Brian Martinson. Ms. Jensen, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Maria Jensen from Recycling Electronics for Climate Action. A shortage of critical metals puts our energy transition in jeopardy. Metals which could be recovered from our old electronic waste. Minnesota's annual e-waste stream contains $3 billion worth of all the metals we need for things like solar panels, wind turbines, and geothermal energy products. We can create 1,700 jobs in our state. An effective collection of this electronic waste is the first step. In Minnesota, we only collect 20% of our e-waste, and much of the rest ends up in landfills where it contributes 70% of the lead contamination there. It is time to replace our old program from 2007, which sends most of its funds out of our state, relies heavily on charging Minnesota residents per item recycled, and relies on Minnesota tax dollars to subsidize its shortcomings. There are three things that are needed to fix this collection system. First, an expanded definition. Our current program covers TVs and computers. HF 3566 will cover the entire e-waste stream. Two, make sure the cost of recycling is covered before the item is purchased. HF 3566 provides free waste recycling for all Minnesotans by improving the manufacturer responsibility program for TVs and computers and implementing a fee on the sales of other electronic devices. And thirdly, by directly reimbursing collection sites for electronics recycled, HF 3566 provides an incentive to collect more material and sufficient funds to spend on marketing and education to raise awareness among residents. This effort will save Minnesotan residents tax dollars by extending the life of our landfills, by preventing lead pollution, and by preventing catastrophic fires caused by improperly disposed of lithium-ion batteries. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Brian Martinson, who will be followed by Tony Quillis. Just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm also, my remarks today reflect the position of Minnesota Rural Counties and the Solid Waste Administrators Association. In 2006, Minnesota banned certain electronics from disposal due to the hazardous materials they contained. In 2007, we followed that up with the Minnesota Electronics Recycling Act, which was meant to have electronics manufacturers cover the cost of recycling these devices. However, the program is not working. Recycling costs are being passed on to collectors and residents, either through direct fees at end of life or being subsidized with tax dollars. HF 3566 continues the product stewardship approach that we have for covered electronic devices, or CEDs, which is the basis of our current law, but is structured to ensure that product producers are covering the cost of collection, transportation, and recycling. It will provide access to free collection and recycling at end of life, which will increase the overall e-waste recycling rate. The CED program also includes a convenience metric, which will ensure access to these collection sites around the state. HF 3566 merges this CED program with RECA's proposal to collect 100% of all electronics products. And these programs share many goals, but recognize the challenges and opportunities of different product streams. SWA continues to support stakeholder engagement on the CED program proposal and would encourage your support of this legislation.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tony Quillis, who will be followed by Mike Griffin. Mr. Quillis, welcome back to the Commerce Committee.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, also speaking on a coalition that includes the Minnesota retailers, who you'll hear from later, and the Consumer Technology Association, which is a national trade association of manufacturers and retailers involved in the electronics industry. I want to break this bill into two parts, Mr. Chairman and members. In the first part, we oppose the existing language, but I want to thank Representative Hollins and Mr. Martinson and the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Solid Waste Administrators. We've had some good constructive conversations. Unfortunately, we haven't got to that peace in the valley yet, but there has been some really good conversations along those lines, trying to address the concerns raised by the counties. The manufacturers are committed to addressing the collection, transportation, and recycling of these electronic products within the current existing system. We want to ensure that there is convenient access and collection for all citizens of the state, no matter where they live. But we haven't found that piece in the valley yet, but we're working towards that, Mr. Chairman. But the second part of the bill that I'd like to talk to you about is we strongly oppose the 3.2% tax on electronic products sold in Minnesota. We're not sure which products are going to be impacted by that tax, the revenue that's going to be raised by that tax, and the revenue, how it works within the existing solid waste system and the SCORE grants that flow through to the counties. And also there's some confusion among the definitions when you try and interplay both of those programs within each other. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stick around for questions, and thank you very much for allowing me to express my concerns.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Mike Griffin, who will be followed by Tony Selt. Mr. Griffin, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. I would like to testify in support of e-waste bill House File 3566. My name is Mike Griffin. I live in Plymouth, Minnesota, House District 42B, that's represented by Representative Cleavorn. I'm a member of a group called the Elders Climate Action of the Twin Cities, and I'm in the Legislative Committee. And we're kind of a bunch of old people that want to try to make a difference. And think we can by speaking to this. As an elder, I believe we need to take a long-term view on many issues related to environment and climate. What this means is thinking about the world we're leaving for our grandchildren. That always makes me tear up. I have two grandchildren. Hugo and Edwin are age 5 and age 8. They took their first trip to the Boundary Waters with me, and it was a moving experience for them, and I want to see that that continues to be available for kids in the future and for families in the future. This is huge. We enjoy canoeing. We enjoy the Boundary Waters. I know that mining may be necessary to have a green economy not based on fossil fuels. We'll need metals and minerals for electric cars, solar and wind energy for our homes, and much more. But I support the e-waste bill 3566 because we can capture, as Representative Holland said, many of those minerals and metals without mining. Recycling 20% of our metals is sad. It's not enough. This is a bipartisan bill, I believe, because we all know that we need to save our environment for future generations. That's not a secret. Our winter this year shows the truth of it. So I hope that you really consider moving this bill on, and I support it, and so does the group that I represent. And I appreciate the opportunity to let you know. And I'll let Hugo know, too.
Thank you.
Hugo's going to be 9. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next testifier is Tony Selt, who will be followed by Bruce Newstead. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. Good afternoon. My name is Tony Selt, and I serve as the Vice President of Sales and Marketing at IRT, a leading electronics recycler based in St. Cloud, Minnesota. For over 27 years, we've been at the forefront of the industry, processing over 45 million pounds of e-waste annually within our expansive 238,000 square foot facility. At IRT, we take pride in our capacity to handle e-waste efficiently and responsibly. With the ability to shred 40,000 pounds of e-waste per hour, we've built a team of 80 dedicated employees who ensure that our operations run smoothly and sustainably. The recent introduction of HF 3566 presents an exciting opportunity for IRT to expand our operations and create additional employment opportunities in the state of Minnesota. In response to this bill, we're prepared to hire 25 to 50 more employees to accommodate increased sorting and shredding demands, potentially extending our operations to additional shifts. This commitment not only benefits the people of Minnesota, but also underscores our dedication to the environmental stewardship. Our expertise extends beyond processing e-waste. We are committed to upholding the highest industry standards. As an R2 certified organization, we hold the newest versions of NADE AAA and the Rio certification as well. And we prioritize safety, sustainability, and transparency in all of our endeavors. Our downstream partners undergo rigorous audits to ensure compliance with OECD standards and our stringent certifications require. We also process the metals that everybody is talking about. A few testifiers have talked about, so I can answer questions about that as well. But in conclusion, I want to welcome any questions or concerns that the committee may have. Thank you for the opportunity to share how IRT is prepared to support the goals of this bill and contribute to a cleaner, more sustainable future for Minnesota.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Bruce Newstead, who will be followed by Tom Johnson. Welcome back to the Commerce Committee, Mr. Newstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and young special guests. My name is Bruce Newstead with the Minnesota Retailers Association. We represent about 1,200 retail stores across the state, including Main Street retailers, regional and mid-sized retailers, and retailers with a national presence. As you've heard through one or two different filters, Minnesota has a strong history in its approach to e-waste. Beginning in 2007, manufacturers of video display devices have been responsible for end-of-product life recycling, and we should be proud of the 450 million pounds of e-waste that have been recycled through the current program. The Accessible program, where, as you heard, 93% of Minnesotans live within about 15 miles of an e-waste collection site, has really helped drive down our e-waste level to a point where it makes up about 2% of our waste stream. However, can more be done? Absolutely. And Representative Hollins, are we willing to do more? For sure. However, this bill has a funding flaw, as you've heard. It includes the 3.2% tax on consumers, as well as a 90 cent fee on cell phones, rather than relying on the proven funding mechanism in place today with our e-waste system manufacturer funding. Minnesotans simply should not be charged additional taxes under a manufacturer-led, manufacturer-driven recycling program. Such a point-of-sales fee really discourages Minnesota purchases, raises great concerns for the competitiveness of our retailers, and will directly impact the pocketbooks of Minnesotans. Just as a quick reminder, last year we raised taxes on consumers about $800 million directly on consumers. That included a metro-wide sales tax, and I apologize, Representative Kangle, delivery fee that kicks in July 1 of this year, 17 local sales taxes, and gas tax indexing. And while all these taxes may go to good programs and have good intentions, they really do end up having an impact on our consumers and our consumers' ability to purchase within the state. That should have been a warning sign for us that we're at a point where we could easily drive sales across borders. This bill's proposed consumer tax on e-waste really only exasperates that issue and, again, can really drive people to more competitive markets outside of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, on with an example. My math is the same as the St. Paul Chambers in your book. Minnesotans will pay a 13.075% sales tax in St. Paul on their graphing calculators for their kids' school, their Bluetooth speaker for a cabin, a vacuum, a lamp, and many everyday items that we rely on, whereas they could drive across the border to Hudson and they would pay a 5.5% sales tax, 13.075 versus 5.05. So instead of directing and pushing our consumers across the border, there are alternatives to fund this program that exist, and we'd ask that you please rethink how this program is funded. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tom Johnson, who will be followed by Nick Schumann. Mr. Johnson, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. Wanted to provide for the committee a little picture of the issue that we're seeing with the current e-waste product stewardship program. It is not achieving the goals it set out to achieve, which are, you know, manufacturers being responsible for the full cost of the end-of-life management of their products. And that is the core goal of these product stewardship programs. Instead, Minnesotans are paying for most of the cost to properly recycle these materials. In the program's data, we see the problem manifest in two major ways. Number one, not all the pounds of recycled materials in Minnesota are covered by manufacturers. And two, when manufacturers are paying for the recycled materials, they're only covering a portion of the costs. So on that first note, Mr. Chair, not all recycled pounds are covered. Over the last 4 years, annually on average, nearly 3.4 million pounds of materials recycled have not been covered by manufacturers. I believe the author covered that a little bit. This amount represents just over 17% of the pounds recycled. So it leaves others to cover the full cost of recycling. And on that second point, on the full cost of recycled pounds are not being covered. With the data that we have access to, we're seeing the manufacturers are covering about a third of the costs. So the remainder of the costs are being covered by counties and or consumers. So those are then passed on. Of course, local governments are then having to pull in this in recycling fees or property taxes to the local government or the private entity to take their old TVs or computer monitors. So we need a solution to fix this issue, and the MPCA is available as a resource working on the bill. Happy to answer questions, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Finally, we have Nick Schumann. Mr. Schumann, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Schumann. I am the OEM Solutions Manager at Dynamic Lifecycle Innovations. We are an electronics recycler and materials lifecycle management company headquartered in Onalaska, Wisconsin, down by La Crosse. We specialize in electronics recycling, IT asset disposition, EPR legislative compliance, and materials recovery. Dynamic has been the contracted state of Minnesota primary electronics recycler since 2016, and we've been participating as a recycler and collective within the current Minnesota electronics recycling program for over 15 years. We acknowledge that the current bill does not meet all of the goals as intended, and we have significant interest in the advancement of electronic collection and recycling, as well as environmental stewardship initiatives in Minnesota. Being an actively involved stakeholder in the state, we do have some reservations about the currently proposed legislature or legislation that I have a few topics on for today. Compliance oversight. Currently, the MPCA effectively oversee one of the nation's most comprehensive and compliant electronic waste programs. This bill's proposal could remove some of that responsibility from the PCA, potentially compromising the oversight needed to ensure responsible recycling. Administrative complexity. The proposed bill introduces numerous funding mechanisms and payment processes involving various stakeholders. This complexity increases the administrative burden, raising concerns about accurately and efficiently processing transactions. Such challenges could jeopardize the effectiveness of post-collection responsible recycling efforts. And then recycler perspective, this bill lacks consideration from all recyclers regarding the proper handling of materials post-collection. Incorporating this viewpoint is crucial for developing a comprehensive program and infrastructure that ensures the long-term success of recycling initiatives in Minnesota. Dynamic is eager to engage in further dialogue regarding the expansion of electronic devices covered under the Minnesota Electronics Recycling Act, with our aim to align with the goal of this bill to reduce electronic waste in our landfills. We are keen to provide additional perspective of an electronics recycler, with the goal of endorsing optimal and a comprehensive program that fosters environmental stewardship into the future.
Thank you. All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion on the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins. I guess I am pretty concerned about some of the testimony about the tax component of this bill, in particular, the idea that we're going to end up with over 13% sales tax on certain items in St. Paul. And so I was wondering if you could help us understand where this 3.2% additional tax comes from and how much money that it's expected that that's going to generate.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I understand your concern with this. You know, I will point out that that's 13.07% tax in the city of St. Paul, which notably has higher tax than a lot of other places in the state of Minnesota. The amount that the 3.2% is what we calculated based on our studies that show this is what it would take to be able to effectively run a statewide electronics recycling program. I will note that, you know, Ramsey County where I live and where St. Paul is, already does electronics recycling and has a partnership with an organization called Repowered, where we can go in and give our prove our address and we can drop off our recycling whenever we want. But the reality is a lot of other cities and a lot of other counties don't have access to that. And also the reality is Minnesota's a big state, right? And so some of those counties are quite large. So it does take some funding to make sure that people have access to electronics recycling when they need it. If you want more specifics about how we got to the exact number, I can pull one of my stakeholders up if that's helpful.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. I agree that St. Paul has higher taxes than everyone else, but, 3.2% on top of the sales tax anywhere in Minnesota gets to be a pretty high number, over 10% sales tax everywhere. And again, compared to Hudson, Wisconsin, I think it is creating a pretty significant competitive problem. It's a 47% increase in the sales tax on items, as it applies to whatever is covered electronic devices. I guess I was curious about the study that's referenced in the Recycling Electronics for Climate Action. I think it's maybe a study from the Iron Range Partnership for Sustainability that we could pull $3 billion out of the e-waste in terms of value. Why isn't that enough money to fund the program?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. That's a great question. So there is an enormous amount of value in the metal in these machines that we have and that we need to recycle. The reality is we don't have the recycling capabilities right now. We don't have the industry around to take all of those materials and actually use, and process them in a way that we can access those materials. So part of what the goal of this bill is to increase collection to then drive industry to be able to hire, as we heard, hire more people, open new recycling facilities to actually be able to access those minerals and be able to feed that into our economic stream.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that answer, Representative Hollins. I see there's probably some value in some of this, updating of the structure. After last year especially, I think Minnesotans are taxed enough. I think this is the wrong approach from that standpoint. I encourage members to vote no, and Mr. Chair, I request a roll call.
There will be a roll call. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. My question is, like you said, based on your research, you calculated a 3.2% tax. We don't have a fiscal note on this yet. So is your intention that if the fiscal note shows that you're going to need more money, is your intention to increase that tax to meet the need? Or how will that play out once we have a fiscal note?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. I'm struggling to be at the microphone and still see you. So we actually did just get a fiscal note this morning, but we are in communication with the different agencies that brought us the fiscal note because there was some confusion about the MPCA versus the Department of Revenue and how much they would need to do to facilitate this program. I do not anticipate needing to raise the amount any further. And I also recognize that there is like a tipping point, right, where people are like, we cannot do this. This is not possible. When we have talked to people from across the state, though, we have gotten a lot of feedback that there are so many fees when you go to buy any sort of electronic, right, be it tax or some sort of fee, administrative fees, that they really didn't see this as being a deterrent from being able, especially large electronics. And I will note that the amendment that we put on here actually removed any sort of fee for cell phones, because that was a feedback that we heard a lot. And cell phones are more like a necessity than a luxury item at this point. And that because they are so small, but disproportionately high cost, that it didn't make sense to have a particular fee on those items. I forget the rest of your question. I'm sorry.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered my question, although you raised something else. Now, I do see that the 90-cent fee is removed in the amendment. I don't see in the amendment, though, where cell phones then are exempted altogether. And I may have missed that. I've got a marked up copy of the amendment.
Is it line 1.4 of the amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hollins.
So cell phones were initially just had a flat fee as opposed to being subject to the 3.2%, and then we eliminated the flat fee as well.
I see. Mr. Ely.
Mr. Chair, line 1.2 of the amendment specifies 1.4 specifies that cell phones are removed from the definition of electronics recyclables and wouldn't be subject to the bill.
Yeah. There's a new Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification. It's a big bill. I didn't have time to figure out where that was. I appreciate that clarification. And perhaps, Mr. Chair, this is a question for you or staff. Do we have that fiscal note available yet?
The fiscal note, I guess, posted this morning, so I would take it. It's available online through the fiscal note service. You can look there. There's not. We're hearing this bill in this committee today with the understanding that the bill is not going to come out of any target that this committee would receive. And I haven't reviewed today's fiscal note, but based on the description of the bill, I would be very surprised to learn there was a cost to the Department of Commerce or the Office of Campus Management, which are the two budget items that we have responsibility for. So. Fiscal note wouldn't be necessarily relevant for the jurisdiction. Not that members can't ask questions about it or anything else, but we don't necessarily need it for our purposes.
It won't affect
our
jurisdiction.
If there was ever a conversation about this bill's cost being part of our budget, the bill would need to return so that we could have that conversation. But I don't think that is going to happen. Yeah, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification. I was just told it's not online yet, so if somebody has access, if we could get it, that would be helpful. I would just say I'm concerned about the language that obviously, as you indicated, I appreciate recognizing that there is a tipping point, but that this will not be a deterrent for most people on making these purchases. And I express concern over that because in our day and age, I don't know what could be a big enough deterrent. We need computers. We need technology. We need these devices in today's day and age. And so, frankly, if we have to, we're going to suck it up and do it. However, Minnesotans are being taxed already at the highest levels they've ever been taxed in history and at higher levels than almost any other state in our country. Now, let me acknowledge and appreciate that you're actually paying for this bill. I appreciate that because we're out of money. And I'm seeing all kinds of appropriations coming through and we're trying to spend a lot more money that we already don't have. So while I appreciate the intention of at least trying to pay for your bill, we can't afford it. And I don't know who you were talking to across the state, but it wasn't my constituents. Because my constituents are going to have a huge problem with an additional 3.2% tax. It's significant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. As I looked at this, and we have a lot of discussion in the legislature, because of our proximity to I guess every state has us, border states. And I think of the areas of Duluth. I think of the areas of St. Paul. I think of the areas of Moorhead and others. If you just take a quick look, the sales tax in the state of Minnesota is at least 50% higher than it is in the state of North Dakota or is in the state of South Dakota. And with the integrated economies that you see in Moorhead and Fargo, and the list goes on across the country, and across our state, because this is how this bill is affected, Some of me make a field trip out of it and go to North Dakota and say, I'm not only going to save sales tax in Minnesota, I'm going to go, I'm going to buy that computer that I may need for medical reasons, and I may buy those other electronic devices there, save money on that, avoid the 3.2% tax that you're talking about in implementing on Minnesotans here in this bill. And they could actually get a bonus by going there and saving 6-7%, because I haven't even added in what the local sales taxes might be. Local option sales taxes and other things that those border state and cities may have. And so the question becomes, does Minnesota also lose revenue because we're not getting to charge the sales tax on it because it's going to a neighboring state? Secondly, the individuals are saving that tax that you're proposing here. And thirdly, we get to recycle those because they're bringing them back to Minnesota. Have you got a plan to be able to help offset those revenues and those losses that could occur? I realize we don't have a formula to figure it out, but I think you would agree with me that that's not too far-fetched.
I'll let Representative Hollins answer the question. I did just want to note, our excellent staff dug up the fiscal note and sent it over to you, Representative New Brindley, and it does show a net savings to the general fund. I don't have it in front of me anymore, but it has a net savings to the general fund. Representative Hollins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I mean, I think you bring some valid points. First thing I want to note is, growing up in Hawaii, we did not have border state issues. So there is one state where that's not an issue.
Or Alaska, for the record.
And then the second thing I want to say is this is something that we are taking into consideration, and certainly part of the fiscal note, you know, the conversations that we're having with the Department of Revenue is how is this going to impact Minnesotans and how is it going to impact border cities? I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but am I allowed to talk about the Senate? Or my Senate author is Senator from Moorhead. And that was very purposeful because we wanted to have conversations about what it's going to look like in border cities and people who might be impacted by this, because I do think that's something that we have to take into consideration. Now, I don't have a magical formula to tell you what it would look like, but I am trusting in our agencies to do their due diligence and consider those things going forward.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And again, the reason I bring it up is it's valid. This committee has heard things about Sunday liquor sales and why we need to have them in the state of Minnesota, because we're going to lose to border states that have these kinds of things. And this just gives people one more reason to want to cross the border to do commerce than to do it within the corporate limits of the state of Minnesota. So, members, I, again, do not support raising taxes, particularly when we may not be able to collect those taxes but still be required to recycle those things, ultimately on the Minnesota tax dollar, or fish them out of a county ditch somewhere. Which means the public folks are going to have to pay for it. And Representative Niska, thank you for asking for a roll call on this very important bill that raises taxes once again in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hollins, how many other states have a system like this, and especially following the theme of the fee structure?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I don't know that number off the top of my head. Can I phone a friend?
You certainly can. Is there someone you think might... No?
I think Maria Jensen.
Ms. Jensen, if you want to come down, if you know the answer to that question.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There are a couple of other states, including California, that has a fee on electronics to fund collection. And we've spoken to Best Buy about how that program works, as well as CalRecycle, the agency that runs that program. And we believe that what we have in our bill is learned from a lot of the things that they struggle with in California to create a better system.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I bring it up is I have a concern for interstate commerce. Certainly plenty of us buy technology and products like cell phones and even TVs online. And so is this going to create an undue burden for interstate commerce, providing a new tax structure for other for businesses who currently their shop is outside of our state, and the impact to interstate commerce, where they may just decide not to do business, not to sell products like TVs, computers, laptops, and cell phones in our state? And to what extent do we have information from other states that that may provide data to us to guide our decision making here?
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I shouldn't say my inclination. I've talked to several sources that say this would not be an issue, that most major retailers and organizations are very used to different tax structures depending on which city they're in. And in fact, there are different ways to compute that, and that it's something that most retailers are very familiar with and do not see as a burden. And I know Ms. Jensen has also talked to some folks about that, so if she might be able to add to that.
If you have a brief comment, Ms. Jensen, you can certainly make it now.
I just want to make a note that some of the items that are being used as examples, for example, TVs and computers, cell phones, gaming consoles, none of those items have the fee on them. Those are part of producer, well, cell phones are excluded, but the other items that I listed are part of the producer responsibility model, so they will not be included in the fee.
I can give you one more follow-up, Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, the way that I read the bill previously was that this was going to impact interstate commerce, the sale of goods from other states, and in that, the only people that this has been benefiting or will ultimately benefit is big business. It's big business who knows how to manage fees through multiple different municipalities, and small businesses are directly impacted by this. I realize that especially in the technology sphere, there's high startup costs. But at the end of the day, this negatively impacts small businesses and their access to markets and to be able to sell to Minnesotans with a fee structure that is so out of line with what we see in the vast majority of other states. Thank you.
Closing comments from Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate your concerns, and I've spoken to many of the folks who testified today, and we will continue to have conversations with them about trying to find to try to find middle ground. I do want to reiterate what Maria was saying, that the items that were already covered under the previous bill and legislation are not subject to the same fee because they are already being dealt with as a manufacturer processing fee. And so it's only the new items that we have coming forward that have not been, that were not covered, you know, those things that were not TVs and fax machines and things like that, that would be covered moving forward. I also want to note that we have support from nearly 50 organizations, from environmental justice orgs to recycling processors, the counties, the rural counties, waste haulers, and even Talon Metals are in support of this bill. And that's because it's so universally seen as a tremendous issue in the state of Minnesota. I hope to continue working across the aisle to address some of the concerns that you all have, but I really do believe that this is something that we need to address sooner rather than later because, you know, our waste is piling up, and frankly, we are losing very valuable metals in, you know, into the bin. I mean, I don't know what else to say, into landfills, which is just not acceptable. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. With that, Mr. Durfee will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Katiza-Watoon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Katiza-Watoon, aye. Lito Driscoll?
No.
Lito Driscoll, no. Representative Bierman?
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Cha?
Aye.
Cha, aye. Representative Dotseth?
Dotseth, no.
Dotseth, no. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Cagle?
Yes.
Cagle, aye. Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Kraft, aye. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative New Brindley?
No.
New Brindley, no. Representative Niska?
No.
Niska, no. Representative Perryman?
Perryman, no.
Perryman, no. Representative Farr?
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Schultz, no. Representative Tabke?
Aye.
Tabke, aye.
With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does prevail, and House File 3566, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Hollins. The next item on our agenda is House File 3858 from Representative Rehm. As Representative Rehm comes down, I will move House File 3858 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Rehm, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have before me House File 3858. It's a bill that helps define what an e-bike is and also talks about active transportation. We are now moving toward a multimodal transportation system where people are not only driving, but they're also walking and biking and taking public transit. And e-bikes have become an important part of this multimodal transportation system. They're very popular here in Minnesota. However, there has been confusion as to what is an e-bike. And this bill helps clarify what an e-bike is. The definition here says that an e-bike is capable of switching modes to operate as a class 1, class 2, or class 3 e-bike. And these e-bikes do not go higher than 20 miles an hour. So that's an important distinction to make between an e-bike and a powered bike. And I do have a couple people here who are willing to testify to this bill.
Great. And I will note for the committee that this bill is primarily a transportation bill. It comes to us, I think, largely because of Section 12 and maybe a few other sections that deal with the sale of e-bikes. I'm not going to restrict people's testimony. I'm not anticipating this is going to take a long time, so we'll just keep going. But I just wanted to kind of let people know why the bill is in the committee. We do have a couple of testifiers here. The first is C.J. Linder. Yep. Mr. Linder, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. My name is C.J. Linder. I'm the education manager for the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. We're supporting this bill because of the tremendous potential for diversifying our transportation choices. As we've seen in recent years, there is great public interest in adopting different modes of transportation, walking more, biking more, and significantly e-bikes do a lot to lower the barriers for people that are interested in riding bikes but aren't able to, whether it's for distance or speed or time, things like that, to ride traditional bikes or take other available options. So there's a lot of interest. People are buying e-bikes, they're riding them more. The reason this bill is in front of us today is that, as we're seeing, there is a problem with things that are being marketed and sold as e-bikes that actually fall outside of the classification system that Minnesota has adopted, which is both giving the e-bikes a bad name and causing potential problems. So, and there's basically two reasons for that. One way in which these non-e-bikes are being marketed and sold is bikes that are tremendously more powerful, more capable, and faster. That's going to introduce safety risks, particularly when those are combined with other bicycles or pedestrians in a shared space. So what should properly be called like an electronic motorcycle, we want to be excluded from these shared spaces so that other users are not at risk. The second issue arises from bicycles that are not properly assembled, sold, charged. These are the machines that have been causing fires, things like that. In New York City in particular, there's actually a cottage industry where individuals are taking bikes, kind of modifying them in ways that they were not intended to, using different batteries, using different chargers, that is unsafe. So our bill in Minnesota is attempting to regulate this market more strictly to eliminate those unsafe, dangerous machines, either from the fire hazard or from the speed and power. And that's the essence of it. So I urge you to support this bill.
The next testifier is Matt Moore. Mr. Moore, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members. My name is Matt Moore. I'm also here on behalf of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota as a Minneapolis resident. But I'm also policy counsel for People for Bikes. We're the national advocacy group for cyclists in the United States. And we're also the trade association for the U.S. bicycle industry. With reference to the previous bill, in 2021, we established a voluntary a recycling program for lithium-ion batteries for e-bikes. Our participating manufacturers pay $15 per battery on import of those batteries to fully cover costs of recycling at end of life. We do support this bill. It contains changes to Chapter 325F that are designed to proactively address some emerging issues with products that are not electric-assisted bicycles but are being sold as such. This has resulted in vehicles that have excessive power or speed being used on trails, leading to conflicts with other cyclists and pedestrians and concerns about potential for crashes and injuries. House File 3858 therefore requires that if a seller describes their product in advertising as an electric bicycle, an electric bike, or an e-bike, but it is not an electric-assisted bicycle, they must disclose to the consumer the name or classification of the vehicle under state law and provide a disclosure statement in their advertising materials or website. This is specifically designed to address products that are advertised as electric bikes. They're sold to consumers who are unaware that the product is actually a motor vehicle under state law. It's required to be registered and licensed, and in some cases to have insurance if it is actually a motorcycle. Additionally, selling a motor vehicle as an electric-assisted bicycle or using the words electric bike, e-bike, or electric bicycle without providing the disclosure is treated as an unlawful trade practice under Section 325.69, which it clearly is. That is not misrepresenting the product to the consumer. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the page 8, section 9, where it's talking about the equipment and the labeling, the manufacturer distributor must apply a label, but I read that there is the label will need to be altered if the bike is modified. Who is responsible for that, and who is responsible for sort of administering and monitoring this?
Representative Ream.
Thank you for that question. Can you point to me exactly where in Section 9 that is? Where says that?
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative New Brindley.
Sorry.
I was looking too.
Thank,
I was
you.
Looking
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking, I mean, that entire section is about the labeling. But so lines 8.2, 8.21, for a vehicle that no longer meets the requirements, the person removes the labeling of an electric assisted bike. Back on line 8.17, a person must not modify so that the bicycle no longer meets the requirement for applicable class. I mean, it's all in that subdivision 6B. And so, again, my question is just who is responsible for this? Some of it is obvious, right? A manufacturer is responsible for that initial appropriate labeling, but there are also requirements for changes.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. So my understanding is this law here is applying to those who sell the bike, so they cannot sell a bike that has been, they cannot sell it as an e-bike if it has been supercharged or modified in a way that makes that bike exceed 20 miles an hour, or if it's not a class 1, 2, 3 bicycle. That's my understanding, but I'm happy to have someone else weigh in. Perhaps House Research could help too, or if one of our testifiers would like to add something.
Before we continue, I do want to note for members, Representative Brindley is operating from her laptop. So I'm looking, I guess she's looking at the first engrossment.
Yes.
If you're looking at what's in your packet, it's the as introduced version.
Oh.
So the page and line sites are
Sorry.
Different.
I am looking at the first engrossment.
That's where I was trying to figure out where we were also. If you want to follow along, you'll need to look online. Representative New Brindley.
Can I just offer clarification? And perhaps, maybe it's just an issue that the underlying statute could use some clarification, because the language says a person must not modify. The person replaces the label. And so maybe the intention is that is a retailer or someone else. Does that question make sense?
It does, and I can speak to that there.
Mr. Moore. Moore,
thank
right?
you, Chair.
Yes.
There are two ways in which the labeling could be changed. In some cases, a consumer may buy an assisted bike, a class 1 bike, and wish to have a throttle added. That ordinarily would happen at the retailer because it's a complicated system. The retailer would then be responsible for changing the label to a class 2 electric bicycle. The other way that this mislabeling happens is when a bike is illegally modified. For example, you can buy what is a motorcycle as an e-bike online, and of course you can buy a nice pack of class 2 e-bike stickers on Amazon and put your sticker on there to masquerade as a legal product. That would be a mislabeling by the person, the consumer that modified that bicycle.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Stevens and Representative. Question I would have is enforcement. Is there going to be any additional requirement for enforcement of this bill once this gets implied? What will that look like? If there's online purchases, what would that look like if people are purchasing online? Because I know that with the world we're living in, we tend to see a lot more purchases online, or like I say, neighboring states. We heard that earlier. An additional tax, will this apply additional tax to our taxpayers as we move forward as well to enforce this program?
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So in terms of enforcement, I don't think there are any new laws right now other than, you know, what we're proposing here, but I'm happy to ask my testifier from Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota to explain that to, or House Research if they want to go into that. But
I think, and I'll look over at Ms. Pompu, but this is all in the Consumer Protection chapter of law, and so the Attorney General has some enforcement authority. But Ms. Pompu?
Chair and members, that's correct. They have an unlawful practice under this new section in Chapter 325F is also a violation of 325F69. So it carries the unfair trade practices enforcement mechanism, and the Attorney General can enforce those sections.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you. Then on the online sales. Good. Thank you, Chairman.
Oh, you're done. Okay, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because we have the different engrossments on here, I just want to clarify one thing. The version that we have does not talk about an appropriation. I believe the engrossed version that's not available in front of the committee right now does have a $225,000 appropriation request. Am I correct on that?
Representative O'Driscoll, yes, Section 14 of the First Amendment, or the First Amendment, of the First Engrossment does include an appropriation to the Commissioner of Transportation. As I noted at the start of this bill, this is a transportation hearing because of the 325F.
Understood. Just because sometimes people, Mr. Chair, don't mean to cut you off, but sometimes people look for different things in the bill that are important to them, and the fact that this doesn't talk about any kind of an appropriation that may or may not be important to members in their decision-making process.
Very fair, Representative O'Driscoll, and just for everyone's this may be self-evident, but I'll just say that again, this is not an appropriation that I would expect would come out of any target that this committee has. We are not responsible for the Department of Transportation's budget or appropriations to it in this committee. So I don't think there's any fiscal implication for the Department of Commerce under this bill. Anything further, Representative O'Driscoll? Representative Katisa-Watoon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Ream. I know that you have been a champion for helping folks with alternate modes of transportation. And I think that as this segment of sales and transit continues to grow, there will be other changes that we need to make. But I mean, as I read this bill, I think the changes within will definitely help keep pedestrians and bicyclists safer. For a relatively small appropriation, I think that keeping people safe on our Minnesota roads is worth that investment. Thank you.
All right. Any brief closing comments, Representative Ream?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So thank you for hearing this bill. Like I said, this is a bill that helps define what an e-bike is, and it helps riders as well as consumers, as well as parents and businesses understand that an e-bike is a bike that is classified as 1, 2, or 3. It does not go more than 20 miles an hour, and we just want to make sure that there's clarity on that. And I appreciate all the work that the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota has been doing to help work with us on the bill. And to Representative New Brindley's question, I will look into this a little bit more closely just to see if that language could be clarified better where it says a person. So I appreciate that comment. And I ask for your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3858 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail, and House File 3858 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Ream. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 3529 from Representative Ryer. I will move House File 3529 be placed on the General Register. Representative Ryer, when you're settled, you can explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. Today I'm presenting House File 3529, which requires health maintenance organizations, HMOs, in Minnesota to be nonprofit, restoring a requirement that was changed in 2017 that allowed for-profit HMOs to enter the Minnesota market. The bill is straightforward. It updates six sections of Chapter 62D to require that HMOs must be a nonprofit corporation organized under Chapter 317A or a local government unit instead of a foreign or domestic corporation or a local government unit as written in current law. It also includes a new section, Section 7, that outlines a transition plan for HMO business currently operated by for-profit HMOs. The transition is scheduled to be complete by December 31st, 2025. There are fundamental differences between for-profit and nonprofit health plans that drive the need for this bill. The key, though, is who the organization exists to benefit and who it's accountable to. Minnesota's nonprofit HMOs have historically been charged with looking out for the health of Minnesotans. In contrast, the responsibility of for-profit organizations is to shareholders and the delivery of financial results that satisfy market expectations. This very responsibility can encourage decision-making processes that favor profit optimization over patient experience. Medicaid and Medicare Advantage are widely recognized as moneymakers for health insurers. The underwriting margins for these products, the amount of premium left over after paying claims and administrative costs, are notably higher than for the insurer's fully insured commercial business. And this is even more true for the top five U.S. plans in this increasingly consolidated market. Access to care concerns have been raised by the Office of Inspector General for both Medicare Advantage and Medicaid Managed Care due to high rates of prior authorization denial. In their words, managed care organizations in several states inappropriately delayed or denied care for thousands of people enrolled in Medicaid, including patients who needed treatment for cancer and cardiac difficulties, and elderly patients, and patients with disabilities who needed in-home care and medical devices. They go on to point that this puts people of color and people with lower incomes at a lower risk of lower quality care and poorer outcomes. In Minnesota, the first HMO conversion reports provides a rich set of insights from public meetings and key informant interviews. And while there are some comments about enhancing competition and critiques of nonprofit health plans, there is also a strong theme of greater trust in a nonprofit HMO system and a sense that local nonprofits are more community engaged and responsive to local needs. The market position of for-profit plans in Minnesota is limited right now, so it's time to act. It's time to again require HMOs to be nonprofit organizations. So I ask for your support for this bill as we seek to improve our healthcare system to ensure affordable, high-quality healthcare for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. We did have one person sign up to testify, Michelle Benson. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, and committee members. I am Michelle Benson, representing the Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota, members including Cigna, Allina Health Aetna, and United Healthcare. Thank you for allowing me to testify. Last year, the legislature requested a report on HMO conversions. As you know, this report was to be released in two parts, February of 2024 and June of 2024. As the committee considers House File 3529, please note the statement included in the executive summary that says, minimal data are available to shed light on whether differences exist between nonprofit or for-profit HMOs with regard to day-to-day operations, enrollee satisfaction, and quality of care.
All HMOs, regardless of status, are subject to Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Department of Commerce regulation. They are subject to medical loss ratios. They are required to offer provider networks at the same standard. They must offer competitive rates, and they must successfully serve their enrollees. In 2017, after extensive debate, a bill including reforms to the small group market, co-ops for farmers, and yes, adding for-profit HMOs to our competitive market, signed by Governor Mark Dayton. It gives consumers and employers more choice to give the best value and options for coverage. No health plan can charge more or provide less than others in a Minnesota market. There's more competition for our Medicaid PMAP programs. There's more competition in the individual market. HMOs, regardless of status, are subject to medical loss ratios at both the federal level and the state level. Two medical loss ratio standards met by every HMO. Any excess funds are required by law to be returned to enrollees. Additionally, MDH gathers information in the 1A report to ensure that only allowed expenses are included in public programs. I'm going to ask the page to distribute a copy of the A1 report, and I would ask members to look at both sides and tell me which side of the A1 report is the for-profit entity and which one is the nonprofit entity. You will see the complex reporting that is required to the Minnesota Department of Health. Many of you remember a few years ago when a plan exited the market and caused chaos for medical assistance enrollees and what those enrollees had to go through in order to find a new plan. HMOs, regardless of status, are parts of complex organizations. If you look in Appendix C of the HMO report, you can discern for yourself that HMOs are often related to for-profit affiliates. The report coming in June will shed more light on the HMO market and demonstrate the similarities between for-profit and nonprofit HMOs. The Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota opposes House File 3529 as we are community partners, employers, and are dedicated to giving value with health coverage to Minnesotans. Thank you, Representative Ryer, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My most obvious question would be the second half of the report that includes, that is, they've been instructed to include legislative recommendations in that second half of the report. Why are we acting on this without the data?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Newbrindley. I don't see this as acting without the data. To me, I see a compelling case that the consolidation of the healthcare industry, the acquisition of practices by the large health plans, the trend in denying care from the large plans does not serve us well, and to me the data are clear.
Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The consolidation of the industry, the for-profit plans literally cover 2.4% of Minnesotans. It doesn't seem like that significant consolidation, certainly within Minnesota. I mean, the vast majority of folks are served by non-for-profit plans. That doesn't seem like a significant consolidation. As far as denying coverage, I mean, as we know, both for-profit and not-for-profit plans are subject to medical loss ratios. So these plans are not allowed legally to collect premiums, to collect money, and not provide care. If they do that, that money is clawed back, and in fact, in this case, it has to go back to enrollees. They don't get to keep that. So what is the basis? Where does the data show that the for-profit plans are denying care?
Representative Ryer.
One excellent source is the federal reports from their investigations, which are finding patterns of overbilling and fraud among the major health plans, which are by and large for-profit plans. We may not have seen it in Minnesota yet, but I am looking out for the well-being of Minnesota and the stewardship here in Minnesota.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That did not address the denial of care. And I would suggest again, overbilling just doesn't bear out because they are not allowed to keep additional resources. They're just not allowed to keep them. I heard in testimony, it's frustrating that there's, quote, greater trust in local non-for-profits, which is frankly based on feelings. That's not based on data. It's not based on facts. And while certainly compassion is an important part of what we do, I hope that we are making decisions based on facts and data. And right now, this bill and this proposal is completely absent that. And I would add to that, there's this strange, I don't understand it, frankly, and not speaking to our non-for-profit HMOs, they do a phenomenal job in the state of Minnesota at providing service to Minnesotans. But just on a broader level, this idea that somehow non-for-profit equals virtuous and for-profit equals evil is a really strange concept, especially when you look at what has happened in Minnesota. It's the non-for-profits who have committed hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud. It's hugely problematic, and this idea that with no data, with this idea of consolidation, I don't know, 2.4% doesn't seem like consolidation. We're told denying of care, but we don't have data to back that up. We're told lots of things with no data and no facts. And it's a bad way to do business. And frankly, I would be curious to know how often the legislature, how often we legislate removing business licenses, like from specific businesses, and if we're going to run into an issue, is there an issue here with a takings clause, with constitutional issues of removing the ability to do this business when folks entered this market in good faith? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And picking back off of what Representative New Brindley said, I'm struck by some of the written testimony that we see from especially the Nurses Association on this bill. And they seem to believe in their testimony that somehow there's a greater level of accountability from a non-for-profit organization by comparison to a for-profit business. And while that is, it's striking to me because it literally mentions in their letter here that a non-for-profit organization has to be led and be have a proper leadership and regulation in order to ensure community benefit and maximize accountability. When in reality, the organizations that lead the for-profit field not only have to have strong leadership at the top, but they have to ensure the viability for those that whom they serve. And so I just I wanted to add that for the record because certainly, as Representative New Brindley just said, there are circumstances where it takes good people leading the nonprofit realm, and there already is that backstop, that level of accountability that exists in the for-profit realm that does enhance the choice that folks have when they're seeking medical care in Minnesota.
There are two people left on the list. We're going to do those two people, then we're going to move to vote on this bill. We still have two bills left today. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this bill. You know, while Ms. Benson was talking, I was thinking about a couple of things. You know, if the medical loss ratio indeed functions to actually make sure that all this money that they collect is going to care, then there shouldn't be a big profit margin, should there? Well, you know, so I don't know if you know the numbers on this. I don't have the numbers today with me. But, you know, of course, health insurance companies make money by collecting premiums, and then presumably they pay less out than they have collected. If that is a business model, indeed, for a for-profit company, they have to be collecting premiums higher than what they are paying out in their costs for medical care, plus, of course, some administrative expense. It is my understanding that United Healthcare, one of the companies that Ms. Benson is here representing, is like one of the most profitable companies in our nation. It is certainly one of the most profitable health insurance companies. And, you know, I don't have the data with me here today, but I think I've read all kinds of concerns about that one in particular, trying to cut off care and using prior authorization inappropriately and so on and so on. So I guess it's really more of a comment than a question. I certainly don't think that the fact that there's a company is not for profit or tax exempt, as we like to say, makes them virtuous. But at least they're not operating in order to make a profit. I personally don't think that we should have companies providing health care or covering health care whose purpose is to make a profit. I believe that people are entitled to health care. It's a human right. And the profit motive should have no place in it here in Minnesota, you know, in terms of corporate profit. Certainly not, you know, satisfying the shareholder as your business model rather than providing care to your people who are enrolled in your plan. So thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions. I just have some comments. And I find today's conversation very disturbing because if you look globally in the insurance industry, there are for-profit and there are mutual companies. There are not-for-profit companies. I'd be willing to bet that if you look around the table and in this room and people who have bought insurance products, they probably don't know whether they bought that product from a company that is a for-profit or a mutual company or a for-nonprofit company. United Healthcare, as was referenced before, provides medical Medicare supplements across the country to people who Medicare Part A and Part B does not cover all of their needs, which we know that Medicare Part A and Part B provide coverage at a much lower rate for reimbursement than the private market does. From the discussion today, we would say, well, it's not quite exactly health insurance, an HMO, but it's close. Let's penalize those folks who are buying those kinds of contracts as well from being able to get those supplements. There have been companies out there from good discussions that we've had in this committee about people who want to end their life and receive life insurance policy and benefits. Those are coming from for-profit and mutual companies as well. And you know what? Sometimes they convert from a mutual company to a for-profit company because it's in the best interest of everybody that's involved. And Representative Brindley, to your comment, you know, about a taking of rights on there, and where have we done this before? Earlier this session, we heard a bill that allowed for telecoms and the local city council by a simple majority vote to close down a private phone company and to localize that in operation at the local level. So it's happening in other areas within the committee's jurisdiction. And it's very disturbing that that is the route that we're moving and taking here in the United States of America, not only the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ryer, I can give you 30 seconds for a closing comment.
30 seconds, that sounds great. When you look at medical loss ratios and the underwriting profit from a Deloitte report, Medicare Advantage, the big five, the ones who are most consolidated in the market, had a 4.7%. All the others, which would include our local HMOs, had a loss of 1.1%. If you look at the underwriting margins for these government programs, it's 3% compared to more like 1% for the commercial products. They are denying care, high rates of prior authorization denial. can raise concerns about access to care and Medicaid managed care. That is the Office of the Inspector General. These are companies that make their profit off of denying care and not putting the patient-provider relationship in the center. Please approve this bill. Please move it forward.
I will renew my motion that House File 3529 be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 3529 is placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Ryer. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3989 from Representative Coulter. I will move House File 3989 be placed on the general register. Representative Coulter, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Last summer, I went camping with my family. It's the first time for my five-year-old and two-year-old daughters. And while sleeping in a tent with two very excited little girls presented its own unique form of stress for me and my wife, and I would imagine the other campers around our tent, we had a lot of fun. Little did we realize, as I suspect many others do not, that many tents bought and sold in Minnesota, particularly older tents, are made with harmful chemicals. Many years ago, tents were made of paraffin wax, other highly flammable materials. And after a number of preventable deaths, provision was made in state law to require that tents be made from flame-resistant materials and certified as such. What we know now is that many of these chemicals are organophosphate flame retardants, or OFRs, that are known to be carcinogenic and endocrine disruptors. These chemicals have been found on the hands and bodies of people who participated in a 2016 Duke University study, and they've been found to accumulate in human and animal bodies, as well as in the air, water, and in sediments. Modern tents are commonly made of nylon or polyester and are significantly less flammable. And the result is that we are one of only two states left with laws still on the books requiring that these tents be made with chemicals that are not only harmful but unnecessary. So my bill, House File 3989, would remove this requirement from law. This has the support of retailers, environmental advocacy groups, and our state fire marshal agrees that it is not, that these laws are not needed on the books anymore. That is the short version of the bill. I'm happy to turn things over to my testifier.
Wonderful. We have one person who signed up to testify, Ivana Stark. Welcome back to the committee.
Hello, Chair Stevenson and members. I'm Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action. We have 132,000 members in Minnesota who support clean water that is safe to drink, cook with, and play in. I'm here in support of House File 3989, which will put Minnesota in line with every state in the country other than New York. And we thank Representative Coulter for bringing this bill forward. The one-pager we submitted gives the history of flame retardants and tents and explains why so many states have made this language update. And today I'm going to help you understand the implications of doing nothing. The International Association of Firefighters have supported this bill across the country, saying that, quote, flame retardants do not provide a meaningful fire safety benefit in lightweight synthetic tents, yet their use means that during the very small number of tent fires that do occur, the smoke will be more toxic, creating a more hazardous fire for both tent users and firefighters. It is well known that the smoke toxicity causes the majority of injuries and deaths from fires. A coalition of outdoor businesses and organizations, including REI, Coleman, IKEA, Columbia, Roughwear, Sierra Business Council, NRDC, Non-Toxic Schools, EWG, and many more support removing this requirement across the country because of the health concerns related to flame retardants. Moreover, Minnesota consumers will benefit from this bill. Currently, only tents coated in toxic flame retardants can be sold. When this limitation is lifted, consumers will enjoy a larger inventory and more choosing power when they shop. Flame retardants from outdoor gear such as tents enter our water with rain runoff when items are discarded and thrown away. Remember that 98 out of our 101 landfills are leaching into our groundwater. This is a strong bill that will bring us into alignment with every state in the country other than New York, and they are working on this bill. It's a priority for them in their next legislative session. And I appreciate your attention to this bipartisan bill and urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter. I love when my colleagues can see a place where we can reduce regulations and we don't have to add new burdensome regulations. So thank you for the bill.
That's right, or taxes.
Closing comments, Representative Coulter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And there's always room for more co-authors, folks. I guess not always, but thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, I think, represents really a long overdue update and will protect health and environment while still ensuring that tents are safe from fire and that every family can enjoy camping just like mine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 3989 be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3989 is placed on the general register. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 3836. Representative Kraft, when you are settled, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move 3836 to the general register.
President Kraft moves House File 3836 be placed on the general register, and then you have the DE1 amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. I move the DE1.
DE1 gets the bill in the shape the author would like us to consider it in. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just verify with the author, as I read the DE, it removes the mandate and in place of that requires disclosure? Am I reading that correctly?
Representative Kraft, that's correct, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. DE1 is adopted. Representative Kraft, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So a little background. In 1996, Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone, a Democrat, and New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, a Republican, championed and passed the Mental Health Parity Act to address the significant disparity between insurance coverage for physical and mental health conditions. The law prohibited large group health plans from discriminating against conditions caused by mental health and substance abuse disorders. And just going forward, I will use the term mental health to refer to both of those. The 96 Act required equal treatment for mental health and physical health conditions. Originally, that act included a provision requiring mental health, physical health parity for long-term disability insurance policies. However, that was removed. Today, 28 years later, we still don't have federal legislation requiring parity in long-term disability insurance policies, although it is done in Vermont and also in Canada. I think it would be safe to say that most people that have long-term disability insurance would have no idea of the limitation of benefits on mental health that exists in many, if not a majority, of policies. Interestingly, the Federal Advisory Council on Employee Welfare and Pension Benefit Plans, which was created decades ago to advise the Secretary of Labor, just released a report a few weeks ago that recommends, one, that Congress adopt long-term disability parity, two, to commission research on actuarial information around long-term disability insurance, and these next two are key. Number three, urge the insurance industry to present plan sponsors with coverage options without duration limits for mental health conditions, and four, provide education to plan sponsors on the impact of duration limitations and long-term disability policies. And those last two are what the bill now addresses. While, as Representative Brindley pointed out, the bill started out to require parity in Minnesota, and I think that's something we should continue. Now this is a notification and disclosure bill. And with that, I will have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. We have two testifiers. The first is Sally Mermelstein. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. And apologies in advance if I mispronounced your name.
I am agnostic as to the pronunciation of my name at this point. Sally Mermelstein, thank you very much for having me. Hello. I'm here because I'm an attorney who represents claimants in their disability insurance claims, especially group claims. And I've done this for my entire legal career, both here in Minnesota and elsewhere. I've also been a claimant in a long-term disability claim who ran into some skirmishes when a hand injury disabled me from my own chosen career, the one I chose as a child as a violinist, which brought me to Minnesota to play in the Minnesota Orchestra. So that now I'm an attorney. In my current position, in addition to doing litigation, I oversee at any one time roughly 70 files concerning denials or terminations of long-term disability benefits. That's what I do all day. I can't leave here with out saying that there are many, many reasons that LTD, I'll call it LTD, long-term disability insurance policies should not include mental illness limitations. But let me, and treat them as, and treat mental illnesses as illnesses of lesser dignity, which is at some level what it's really about. Let me highlight some of my top three reasons, let's say. The limitations themselves, if you haven't read them, are unintelligible, often ambiguous. They lead to tons of indeterminacy, and nobody really knows what they mean for the most part. They encourage people, secondly, to hide their comorbid mental illnesses, which benefits no one. And they are the source of a lot of mischief. So I know this is speed dating, and I don't have a lot of time. I wish I could give you some examples of the mischief, but let me just say that in the plaintiff's bar, we do have a joke, which is that we've told for decades, which is, if you find yourself in a situation where you have a devastating health diagnosis, or if you are in so much chronic pain that you can't perform your occupation, make sure you don't get too depressed about it, because it's very likely that your LTD benefits will be cut off due to the mental illness limitation. That actually happens a great deal. Mm-hmm. Somehow the sort of the physiological claim is infected with your comorbid mental illness limitation, and we're fighting this all the time. But luckily, this isn't something that's going to happen to any of you, because the state of Minnesota has actually decided not to have mental illness limitations in the state policy that insures you. So you are the lucky ones. However, I understand you're looking at a bill that would require notice to employers, at least, that there are disability policies that don't include these mental illness limitations, and that's certainly some incremental progress as I see it. I say that because in our practice, we often encounter a situation where the employer is quite surprised that the employee is being denied their disability benefits, or that their disability benefits are being terminated. And we learned that they had very little knowledge of the policy that they purchased and what provisions were included in there. There's some evidence, partly from the ERISA Benefits Council, investigation, that employers tend to buy off-the-shelf policies, and they don't really know, they haven't really investigated the consequences of their decisions. So to the extent that they are not making those kinds of decisions with open eyes, I do believe this bill would open their eyes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Robin Rowan. Welcome back to the committee.
Chair Stevenson, committee members, I'm Robin Rowan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. I want to start by thanking Representative Kraft for the significant amount of time and thought that he put into this bill, and as well as his passion on mental health issues. So long-term disability is an important voluntary product that replaces a portion of an individual's income if they were unable to work for a period of time. And usually it stacks on top of short-term disability, which is 12 weeks. Coverage can last until the Social Security retirement age. So studies have estimated that group long-term care disability insurance will save the federal government $25 billion over a period of 10 years, $10 billion in Social Security disability insurance alone. And yet only about one-third of employers provide this benefit. So what we've discovered is that agents and brokers in the employer benefits space tend to spend most of their time talking about health insurance and how employers can respond to rising health insurance costs, which doesn't leave a lot of time to talk about supplemental benefits. And so we believe the DE amendment will encourage additional focus on benefit choices, while at the same time allowing individuals and employers to purchase a wage replacement policy that works for their individual circumstances. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just in case anyone needs a little bit more background to determine how they want to vote on this, long-term care disability insurance is sold by for-profit companies.
Closing comments. Representative Kraft. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you for the amendment. With mandates come increased costs, right? It would become much more expensive to add this benefit. And my concern is, you know, I lost both of my brothers to substance use disorder. And one of those brothers maintained gainful employment. In fact, high-level employment was very successful throughout his adult life. My other brother struggled his entire adult life and could never really get it together, right? However, along the way, there were a lot of employers who were willing to take a risk by hiring someone who they knew was in recovery and who they knew struggled with substance use disorder. But I think that might become really difficult for employers to do if they are forced to mandate a coverage that will likely be used just because of the high rate of relapse among folks in substance use disorder or with substance use disorder. So while I appreciate the intention and the goal of supporting these folks, I just wanted to offer that there could be some unintended consequences of maybe employers being a little less willing to take risks on people who struggle, who really need that chance, that leg up. So thank you for the amendment. I think that'll make a difference.
Closing comments, Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is a new area for me. I do think that parity between mental health and physical health is the right way of thinking about it. I appreciate that it's a complex area, and I really appreciate Representative Brindley's comments. I think this is a good first step for us. Please support it.
All right. Representative Kraft renews his motion that House Bill 3836, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3836, as amended, is placed on the general register. Members, a reminder that we will be having a hearing on Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. To take up our omnibus and a few other bills. I look forward to seeing you then. Even if it snows, the meeting is adjourned.